A number of points randomly connected. A topological fiction. Toronto, number one. He had no name for what he wanted to say. The message was a nameless one. But fly posters had a chance to bear the fruit he suspected their seeds promised. The arrival of a Christ, perhaps, or the reappearance in his life of his father. He didn't know, but he felt he had to put them up anyway. His father had left when he was 5 to go work in the Gulf of Mexico on an oil rig, but who had never returned, much to his mother's delight. But for Derek, he became the man this abandonment destined him to be. At least, that's how he told it in each of his counselling sessions. The results, or solutions as he wanted to call them, despite their failing to resolve anything. Of these, hour-long meetings between him and a series of counsellors led directly to the posters, and in them, he advertised the name of the oil companies drilling for oil in the Gulf of Mexico. They had to cover all of the companies from 1981 onwards, the year his father left, until the present, because his mother maintained that she never even knew for whom exactly his father was going to work. And this list of information started to appear on the streets of Toronto around the same time as the Keystone Pipeline was touted. The pipeline had set his mind in motion, and the course of the pipe spanned out away from him, as if the blocks he trudged in the winter snow of Toronto's Yorkdale and the melancholy of losing his father to silence and mystery grew giddy with possibility and a solace that lay squarely in his imagination. The Keystone Pipeline got a lot of bad press in Canada, it is true, but for Derek, these thousands of kilometres of conduit rushed away across a landscape in the dark to reach Steel City, moving on south from there to the sultry marshes of places he had never been to, nor would ever visit, but arriving at night, in his daydreams it was always at night, to huge lit-up refineries in Houston and Port Arthur, where ships would sit sleeping in perpetual berth and floodlights would keep the night shifts working at full pelt. For the people of Yorkdale, the poster spoke of nothing other than a mystery that seemed to be very much rooted in the present. In the glum daylight of winter, smudges that they passed in the afternoon, and which by night receded to the darkness of the locale of lamp-lit streets that led to the cosmic architecture of dreams. Glasgow, number one. He'd stared out the obtusely angled window and narrowed his eyes. The truth was, his plane was not going to take off, and there was nothing he could do about it. This left him with an actively receding destination that was exceeding his ability to grasp it, because he was failing to move toward it. And as such, there was nothing other for him to do than to turn around and retrace the journey he had just made, frustrated and cursing. The falling slow made a mockery at his efforts to expedite. The cause, such that it ever stood a chance, random and predicated on chance as it was at the mercy of the weather. Jonathan shook his head, cursed once more for the pure and concentrated sake of it, and turned on his heel, hoisting his shoulder bag up over his arm and poised his head aloft in what he hoped was a businesslike manner, a gesture that would give him a sense of determined purpose, as if in reflex his body was allowing any stranger that should look at this man to think, there is a man who's succeeding in his life goals, a man with a point to make. Toronto number two, the era of uncertainty. The long cycles of oil exploration and development do not always align well with the shorter cycles of the economy. Just as Shell bet heavily on deep water, the severe recession of 1981 further depressed falling oil demand. For the first time in 34 years, US oil consumption hit a plateau and began moving downward. During 1985 and 1986, oil prices collapsed down to $10 per barrel as both OPEC and non-OPEC producers, principally Mexico and the North Sea, saturated the market with crude. Combined with the rising price of lease bonuses before area-wide leasing and disappointing fines, the recession sucked the wind out of drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. Expensive development projects in the Gulf of Mexico were cancelled or shelved. The construction of mobile drilling vessels and other kinds of offshore servicing equipment, which was a major part of heavy industry along the Gulf Coast, fell sharply. Some analysts began to write off the Gulf of Mexico as the Dead Sea. And that's from the National Commission on the BP Deepwater Horizon Oil Spill Offshore Drilling. Glasgow number two, post-Nobels. Dennis's French teacher once passed an entire class with an elaborate story about posting Nobels. It came about when the word for poster came up in Fiche, and the teacher, Mr. Andrews, went on to describe how in France, say in a city like Paris, one often sees a prohibition chiseled directly into stonework of public buildings. Défense de Fiche, loi de 29 juillet 4481, thereabouts, which meant flyposting was prohibited. And from this, he tried to teach the class how nouns, for example, in Fiche, could easily morph into verbs, affiche, s'affiche, and idiomatic nodal phrases, défense de Fiche. And it was while translating this last example as post no bills that Mr. Andrews began telling his story, and as a result, he failed in his lesson. He recounted how as a young boy, he had mistakenly understood this sign that appeared randomly on the walls and doors of his little corner of Glasgow to mean that these houses weren't to get any bills in the post, as in general amenity bills, electricity, water, gas, because they were derelict and nobody lived there anymore. They, more often than not, appeared fixed on the ruined walls of Cranhill's more down-and-out buildings. This, he told the class, led me and a friend to decide to break and enter one of these buildings. I think it was somewhere along Cartain Road, if any of you know that, down toward what became the Ford Shopping Centre. Long before that, though, it's since been demolished, and for a lark, we decided one Sunday to kick a door in the back and see what we could find inside. What is it about empty and shut-up buildings that make young boys want to break into them and find out what they have inside? The students just sat there indolent, blank, not even registering that he had posed a question, even though it had been largely rhetorical. Well, anyway, we went inside and didn't find much, but then my mate started to smash windows with anything he could find, old pieces of pipes and stones and shoes, and come to think of it, the place might have been a shoe factory, as there were a lot of shoes. Anyway, there were a lot of windows mined, so soon enough we drew attention to ourselves inside this shut-off building. A couple of trespassers as we were, and sure enough, when we got bored and went back out to kicked in door, there was your policeman waiting for us, took us in and all, and that was how I got to be picked up from the police station by my mother when I was just a wee un. So post no bills doesn't have anything to do with electricity bills or occupancy. It just means don't post any posters there. At the end of this story, Dennis looked around at the rest of his classmates, and they all remained sitting, indifferent as they had been for the entire class. His mate Paul asked in a cheeky way if that means he'd been arrested, but the teacher shook his head as if to say he'd failed to learn the moral of the story. Andrews had a habit of digression that was nothing other than a ruse to keep himself entertained and to save him from actually teaching. A few moments later, the bell went, and the class slowly, lethargically rose collectively and dispersed through the door, already forgetting whatever it is that they had just been told. Paris. This brings me to my point. In Paris, on the evening of 27th of December 1895, Georges Méliès, whose full name was a rather marvellous, somewhat sing-song Marie-Georges-Jean Méliès, attended a projection by the Lumière brothers' new invention, which in turn was a continuation of the work started by one Edward Muybridge, nay Edward James Muggeridge, and his invention of what he called the zoopraxiscope. Muybridge's life was one long picaresque journey to capture the world as it opened itself up to modern man and woman, particularly that giant domain of exploration, the western coast of the land of the United States of America. The process was capturing up the world on film. It was ghost trap, a motion study, a dream of being able to prove how horses, and by extension men, move in the blink of an eye. Méliès was immediately taken by this new invention and on the spot asked if he could buy one, which the brothers politely refused. They saw it as a scientific instrument and as such not suitable for theatrical showmen such as Méliès. But this initial setback didn't stop him. He acquired the technology and adapted it and became a prolific early filmmaker. Works such as Voyage to the Moon quickly became classics in this new art form. One of his earlier works is of interest to us because it captures the difficulties as well as the possibilities of Jonathan's project. Défense de Fiche is from 1896 and is only 70 seconds long. In it, a flyposter waits as a gendarme walks past one of the same signs Mr. Andrews would use years later in a stuffy Glaswegian classroom. He then puts up a small poster only for another flyposter to cover it with a much bigger poster. They squabble before running upon the gendarme's return. As they leave the frame, the sergeant of the gendarme comes along and, seeing the misdemeanor, berates the gendarme for not doing his job properly. The moral of the short film could be about the difficulties of responsibility, or the meaninglessness of authority in the face of competitive determination, or it could just be a meaningless comedy sketch of theatrical showmen. Berlin. But the point is not the fly posting, but rather the position of Méliès' camera, fixed and rooted to the spot, it is unmoving. The bill posters and the police walk past it. They are caught almost as it were by chance. And as I write this story in Berlin, I read an interesting essay by Augustin Fernandez Malo, a Spanish novelist who has brought his art into the new century with something approaching vitality, which is no mean feat. He makes a metaphor out of Méliès. What great names everyone has, and I don't even mean to exaggerate them. Méliès, Muggeridge, Malo, Monk. And his rooted camera being similar to the conception of the go-ahead, turn-the-page, codex-bound novel of the 20th century. The point of view of early cinema was the same as the theatrical spectacle. The audience were rooted in their seats, and the action happened as the characters entered and exited the frame. The next big advance in the art of film came when the camera was picked up and followed its subjects. The moving image gained the ability to move in the world, and as such, the audience succeeded from their fixed chair, their vision accelerated. The same must happen to the new story and how that story is told. The point then becomes that flyposting a la Méliès and Munch and Derek is an activity that leads to palimpsest, a slow eradication across points of prohibition, like a signal made out of moonlight on a ruffled lake, fleeting and then gone for good. And viewing it after the fact, we can track it as a tireless steadicam speaking from across the world's cities, like a radicant spreading roots in a heterotopic fashion. It creates in these cities topographical sets, much like in this story or in the work of Malo. For these random points connected by the action of Munch, we have a clear, or should I rather say pure, to keep the metaphor biological, example of the radicant moving in time and space. We are talking here not just about contemporary art and the globalized figure of the contemporary artist, but about story itself and how stories are told. Brussels. The law on the freedom of the press of the 29th of July 1881 came about due to the need to give media a new position and establish the press's freedom in the Third Republic of France and to streamline advertising and public space. And while it led to a liberalisation of the press, it also led to a toxic arena for opinions to swarm around in, leading Émile Zola to condemn the media in his famous J'accuse, itself an impossible text to publish without the provisions of the laws on the press, in which he condemned the press for its contribution to the Dreyfus affair. And I quote, "A gutter press in heat, making its money out of pathological curiosity, perverting the masses, higher up on the scale, the popular newspapers, selling for a sou, inspire atrocious passions," end quote. Now, while we browse Facebook in this internet cafe on Rue de Merode in Brussels, we need to stop a moment and dwell on this link someone has posted, and which is accompanied by a photo of the French president. If you think of a paparazzo waiting to take the photograph of a slimmed down President Hollande as he walks out of an apartment building, his flappy, jovial face outside crammed into a helmet, the apartment that of his mistress, and the apparatus of this paparazzo, let's call him Marcel, and then think of Muybridge developing the Ur camera in California and Stanford's stud farm at Palo Alto, and how the site would be home to the next century's grandee, the internet, and how the image Marcel is about to capture would normally be restricted by the law of 1881 to keep the private lives of elected officials just that, private, but which he will disregard and sell to the magazine Closer, who will publish them and so bring about one more political scandal. We are, if we come to think of it, suddenly buoyed in the middle of a topological space, which is exactly my point. And there's a footnote to that point. At the beginning of the 20th century, someone realized that the camera could film moving along with the actors, going behind them with shots and reverse shots, as if to say, we're going to cover all the points of view so that spectators can move with the camera, so that they are ubiquitous and mobile. We're going to lift them out of their theater seats and put them in the set itself so that they see what is behind it. This seems an acceptable simile for what the novel could be when expanded to the internet with its corresponding exo-novel. Not content that the reader be a single person in a theatre seat, the novel could displace itself with new systems and media provided by the internet. If taken all the way, it is a tremendously ambitious idea that, in my opinion, when sufficiently developed, will replace what film is today and what architecture was in its day. I'm referring to an artistic medium capable of encompassing and transforming all artistic practices. It's an idea rooted in the Baroque, the idea of filling it all up, occupying all available space, exhausting all technical possibilities. The idea not of movement alone, but of accelerated movement. And that's from Augustin Fernandez Melo, Topological Time, in Priorecto Marcello Land, Poporiza, and a brief comment on the extra novel. And one further footnote to the mention of Marcel, the photographer. There is no reason I can think of for this fabrication. The real name of the photographer involved is Sebastian Valiella, who years before also broke convention and published the first pictures of President Mitterrand with his secret daughter. But let's stick for now with the character being called Marcel. San Francisco. Derek's father didn't last long in the Gulf of Mexico all those years before. The work quietly dried up that he had initially been lured there with, and so he also called it the Dead Sea, for he felt somewhat dead inside, as if the heat and humidity had killed something off in him, something he would never find again. And so when he was offered a mechanics job in California with the shipping company that serviced the BP rigs, he decided immediately to take it. Over the years, he forgot about his life in Canada, made many women deeply unhappy. But he himself remained, the most part, content. After all, he considered himself reborn, and therefore in possession of a modicum of good fortune. The winter when Clinton got re-elected saw him grow a bit unsatisfied with his work, and he took to going for long walks along the coast. This started when he got in his old beaten-up Buick and decided to go for a drive, and maybe head down south to San Francisco to see the trams and hills he only knew from TV. And he liked to watch TV. But the truth is, he didn't know where he was going or why. Everything felt slightly off-kilter suddenly in his life, and he guessed maybe he was starting a midlife crisis. Again, something he only knew about from TV. But Julia, the last woman he had an affair of any meaning with, an airline steward for United. She had told him about her ex-husband at Lent and the steady litany of cliches he had inflicted on her. The motorbike he couldn't afford, leather jackets, an affair with a 26-year-old with big tits. All this had led to their divorce, and Derek's father had paid attention because in the telling of the information, he recognized the knowledge he knew belonged to him and not Julia. And so he stopped dating her. And now he was taking long walks on his days off along the coast of California, thinking for the first time in years of Canada and his own father, an alcoholic Indian he knew nothing about, and his mother who spoke French only in her sleep. And he would reach this headland where the small building of the world's largest camera was perched, and stare at it and beyond out into the sea and the water and watch the sunlight and think of how he didn't even have a photograph of his son Derek. And that had made it easier at first in that crucial year in Port Arthur, but now it just spoke of regret, like a missed ship, or like he did not know what. He had no name for how he felt or the decisions he had made. He was a motherfucker, he guessed, judging again by TV. If his life was made into a TV show, he's pretty sure at some point he would be called a motherfucker.
If our Christmas, a smelt nutmeg. The shop was softly lit with spotlights. The spotlights lit on built-in cabinets. The glass cabinets displayed costume jewelry. If you want to try them on, you would have to ask one of us, who would then ask the manager for the keys. The manager sat behind the till. The manager had a soft voice, soft and controlled. When she got upset, her voice got softer. She taught me how to be passive-aggressive. That was the ground floor. Clothes were downstairs. Elton John's costumes, Madonna's, Ozzy Clarke, vintage Chanel. Haute couture. I was there to earn money, yet I wanted to spend the money. I did think about going back to the travel agency I worked before, photocopying passports, making teas. At the shop, I saw buyers from fashion houses, the rich, people with their bodyguards, students, browsing tourists and shopping tourists. I learned where each item was in the jam-packed shop. For Christmas, depending on how well we did that year, we got the vouchers that we could use at the shop. I walked around my rented ex-council flat like a peacock ready to fly. And of course, penguins don't fly. A child closes the door to her room and listens. As soon as it gets quiet outside, she cuts the belly of her money pig open with her Swiss Army knife. The Swiss Army knife was given to her by the brother of her father, who is a dick. He loves his own voice, all the siblings of her father, in fact. They speak with a funny accent and they say mean jokes. The entire family is a dick. But the Swiss knife, all her savings fall out. She packs the coins into a black plastic bag. The black plastic bags are only for special products. The local pharmacist said it when he put sanitary pads in it. The child does not know it yet that she will become one of the biggest consumers for sanitary products one day. She does not know it yet that she will begin to bleed on the same day as her father dies, and from then on she will bleed for the next 9 months. She will learn the fragility of life, mortality. She will learn that death is the only absolute and promised thing in life. The last breath, the transition from the living to the non-living, will touch her deeply. After helping her mother with practical stuff, she will fly back to London and she will go to see her GP. The doctor will say there's nothing wrong with her physically. The doctor will say it is likely psychosomatic. The doctor will say she ought to take an iron supplement. There she will think about what a shaman once said. The shaman said she was born to be a shaman and she should become a shaman. Days will go by, the summer will come. She will park a car, she will drive to Basel. She will do readings by the entrance of a historical building. It will be a super sunny day. She will be wearing her sunglasses. From there, she will drive to Berlin. In Berlin, she will throw up on the street around 6 in the morning. And she will say, fucking North Korean, alcoholic, blood. When she wakes up sometime in the afternoon, she will pose in front of a graffiti of a penis. She will keep on driving. She will bleed in Münster, Cologne, Antwerp, Brussels, Ghent, Calais, and London. And one winter day, it will stop. The child feels rich carrying the heavy plastic bag full of coins and goes to one of those shops that sells everything. Pencils, metal wires, hammers, and brooms. After dinner, after brushing her teeth, after saying a good night, after turning the lights off, and after covering herself with a duvet, she switches on her brand new torch. The strongest of all warriors are these two: time and patience. Patience. Patience.